Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is California Democrat Jim Costa, who joins us to discuss the upcoming farm bill and the drought in his home state. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Supreme Court opted not to hear arguments in a case challenging the reach of state pesticide labeling requirements. The High Court opted not to hear a challenge that could have overturned state laws that are more restrictive than the federal statute. Monsanto, which is now owned by Bayer, has settled more than 100,000 claims that the glyphosate found in Roundup caused cancers in plaintiffs across the country. Farm groups expressed their disappointment in the ruling, but some of those same groups also welcomed news on a case the court will hear later this year. The U.S. Solicitor General backed the argument made by the American Farm Bureau Federation and the National Pork Producers Council in a challenge to California's Prop 12. An amicus brief filed recently concludes California does not have an interest in the welfare of animals outside the state. Farm groups argue the law violates interstate commerce laws. The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear the case in October. And finally, if you were keeping an eye on livestock policy on Capitol Hill, you had a busy Wednesday. The Senate Ag Committee held a long-awaited markup for a bill to mandate certain amounts of cash trade in the beef industry. There was also committee action on a bill to create a special investigator to enforce the Packers and Stockyards Act at the Department of Agriculture. Over in the House, the Ag Committee took a close look at the dairy policy of the 2018 Farm Bill. That part of ag policy has seen some big changes in recent farm bills, from the margin protection program of the 2014 Farm Bill to the dairy margin coverage program of the 2018 legislation. California Democrat Jim Costa has taken a special interest in dairy policy during his time in Congress. When we spoke to him, we asked him if big dairy changes were coming again in 2023, or have the industry and Capitol Hill finally gotten it right?
I think when we talk about American agriculture and the dramatic changes as it relates to the impacts of climate change, international trade, certainly we could not have ever anticipated in the last farm bill the pandemic and the upheaval the pandemic would have on food supply chains that impacted every commodity in American agriculture, including dairy. I noted in my comments yesterday that after the pandemic, we saw the price of milk drop below $10 per hundredweight, and now we see it at $27 per hundredweight. And, you know, the closure of schools and restaurants obviously had an impact to all of American agriculture. And we're still not out of the woods yet, so to speak. They're talking about potentially a new variant coming in this fall. I think the USDA, with its efforts to ensure that we restore the food supply chain, is still a work in progress, although we have made strides, to be sure, on the empty container issue and the demurrage issue on legislation that we passed and the president signed. And we're already starting to see the empty containers be reduced from almost 80% to 40%. But clearly, you know, with the invasion by Russia to Ukraine and the impacts on not only important wheat and other grain issues, vitally essential for food stability, but also fertilizer costs. And so to answer your question, and this is a long answer, I don't know a farm bill that we reauthorized, and I think that's why we reauthorize it every 5 years, can fully anticipate the changes that are going to take place not only in our country but around the world. And that doesn't go into impact when we talk about the dairy industry and the issues of a safety net on how we make those adjustments. And of course, there's incredible technology changes. When I'm a third generation dairy family, but we sold our dairy a number of years ago. I'm still farming permanent crops, but we did not have the advantage of genetics that you now employ in the dairy industry? Are the other technological advances, are the new dairy products that provide whey and protein and other means that have really are a testament to the incredible ingenuity in the American dairy industry and American agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I want to talk to you about some other subjects outside of the Farm Bill, but just quickly here, Congressman, obviously the upcoming midterm elections are going to play a bit of a role here in this, but I wonder, do you think the Congress, the House and Senate, are on the track to write a new Farm Bill and pass it in 2023, or do you think the legislation is going to need a little bit more time?
Well, as you know, and I think your viewers know, the reauthorization of the Farm Bill traditionally has been a bipartisan effort, and I expect that to be the case in next year, regardless of what the outcome is in the elections. To be sure, we'll have our differences, as we have had in the past, whether it be in the SNAP program or in other issues. I think one of the most important elements that's going to determine how smooth it goes in the Senate and the House is going to be an agreement on baseline funding. A lot of demand as it relates to the impacts of drought and other weather conditions, as it relates to safety net issues that we find itself making, I think, important inroads on the EQIP program, on the MAP program, as it relates to, as an example, and I raised the issue yesterday, digesters. I mean, in California, where we produce 20% of the milk products in America, we've got 119 digesters in place that are converting that methane into energy, and also dealing with our waste stream. And any efforts to employ new technology through the EQIP program or through the MAP program or through NRCS are valuable tools. And therefore, our ability to expand those tools is gonna in part determine on what the baseline funding is. I've talked with Chairman Stabenow about this about 2 weeks ago. And I think if we can get an agreement on raising the baseline funding for the various titles within the Farm Bill, then that will have a lot to do on how smoothly it goes in the reauthorization next year, because you can, you know, use best management practices on a regional basis throughout the country for American agriculture, but you got to have the resources to make that work. And if we're stuck with baseline funding from 5 years ago, then it's going to be a problem.
We'll be right back to discuss the drought and beef industry legislation with Congressman Jim Costa right after this.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back. California is one of several states currently experiencing a prolonged drought. When we spoke with Congressman Jim Costa from the state, we asked him, short of some kind of action to make it rain, has Congress done enough to address the issue?
Well, my initials are JC, but I can't make it rain. And the fact is that we've done some short-term efforts, certainly in last year's American Rescue Plan and the bipartisan infrastructure package that provides additional funding for water efforts in California and elsewhere. I look at it in two ways, having chaired the Senate Agriculture and Water Committee in my days in Sacramento, and of course the years now I've spent in the House Ag Committee and Natural Resources Committee, both which have impacts as it relates to California agriculture. 99% of our agriculture is irrigated. And therefore, we say where water flows, food grows. With the impacts of climate change and other factors that we've had to deal with here in California, we have a broken water system, period. And it's just didn't come just because of the extreme drought conditions we're facing today and last year. This has been going on for several decades. But of course, Lake Mead and Lake Powell on the Colorado River, in which California receives a significant amount of that water, is at the lowest level since the dams were constructed. And we share that water with upper basin states and lower basin states. So we're in a effort in California to do short-term efforts to our drought and longer-term efforts to determine what it will take to make California agriculture sustainable. In other words, that will balance our surface supply water with our groundwater. We will, in a period of 10 to 15 years, we hope, eliminate the overdrafting issues. But by the way, you know, we overdraft in other parts of the country as well. And it would be good for other regions to look at California as an example. You know, I liken the overdraft issue on water in California to what my father told me when I was in college and I opened up my first checking account. And I thought it was pretty cool. I had a checking account. And my dad told me, he says, you know, that checking account's only good as long as you make deposits. You can't keep writing checks when you no longer put money in the bank. And our groundwater is the same thing. You can't keep overdrafting your groundwater supply unless you have a long-term balanced use on your recharge. And it's hard, but we're trying to come to grips with that in California today and over the next 10, 15 years. So we need short-term funding to deal with immediate impacts of the drought and the land fallowing that's taking place last year and this year. And then we need long-term investments to provide additional storage, additional groundwater recharge, and to make sure that our water conveyance facilities are capable of moving water from where we have it to where we don't. And that's balancing our water needs for agriculture in California, for our urban needs, and for the environment. Mm-hmm.
Before I let you go, one more quick question for you, Congressman. We've seen the Senate Agriculture Committee take action on legislation to mandate certain amounts of cash trade in the beef industry. They had a markup on that bill and passed it through the committee this week. That bill has been introduced in the House, but there hasn't been basically any committee action on the legislation. Why do you think that is, that we haven't seen the level of activity in the House that we've seen on that bill in the Senate?
Well, I think you've got a very prolific author in the Senate who's been working on this for some time. I think there's still questions as to how you translate that into good public policy that will have the intended effects that the author in the Senate would like to have. And I think we have to sit down and have a conversation on how we do that, assuming the bill gets out of the Senate and comes over to the House. And I look forward to working with our colleagues on a bipartisan basis in the Senate, with my colleagues here in the House, to see if we can reach some compromise that would address the issues that are of concern.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's quite a bit on our agenda today. The farm bill, the drought, cattle politics. We could probably check off a few more boxes, but in the interest of everyone's time, I think we'll call it a day there. Congressman Casa, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Spencer, and it's always good to be at AgriPulse. And from the golden fields of the San Joaquin Valley and those almonds that are part of my farm. So I'd be happy to have you all out here in California and see some of the incredible agriculture that we're able to do here in California that I'm very proud of.
Heck of a deal. We'll have to schedule that trip sometime soon. Thanks for joining us, Congressman.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back to discuss this week's news with our panel. But first, Hannah Pegel checks in with a sorghum producer in this week's From the Field.
In this week's From the Field, a Kansas sorghum grower wants to know more about transporting U.S. commodities to food insecure areas. Take a look.
Hi, I'm Doug Kiesling from Chase, Kansas, and I'm an NSP board member. During a recent hearing, Secretary Vilsack noted the cost of shipping U.S. commodities to countries in need is higher than the cost for the grain itself. How can we make getting U.S. crops like this to vulnerable individuals or countries more cost effective?
Thanks for the question, Doug. In May, the Department of Agriculture announced it would have to spend $388 million to ship and distribute $282 million worth of U.S. commodities to Yemen and five African countries. Why the big bucks? The U.S. has a cargo preference requirement, which requires half of American food aid to be shipped on U.S. flag carriers. A recent study by the American Enterprise Institute found the cargo preference rule added about 36%, or $47.5 million to the cost of shipping food from fiscal year 2013 through 2018. The markup is even higher for commodities shipped in bulk carriers versus containers. In 2018, the cargo preference added 40% to the cost of shipping bulk commodities. But there is work underway to address the issue on Capitol Hill. Delaware Democrat Chris Coons is the chair of the Senate State Foreign Operations Appropriations Subcommittee. He has joined Iowa Republican Joni Ernst in proposing to temporarily waive the cargo preference requirement. If you'd like to have your question answered on From the Field, send an email to newsmakers@agripulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. Excited to be joined by this week's panel to discuss the Farm Bill as well as some recent action by the Securities and Exchange Commission. I'm really looking forward to the discussion. Joined this week by Aubrey Bentencourt with the Almond Alliance of California, Paul Bleiberg with the National Milk Producers Federation, and Ethan Lane with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Paul, I want to go to you first because we saw the House Ag Committee take up action on dairy policy this week, really do the oversight of the 2018 Farm Bill and look at the current policy. But as you well know, there's been some big policy changes in the last couple of farm bills. And I wonder, is this a matter where you're expecting more kind of revolutionary, more big changes in the next farm bill? Or do you think that you and your colleagues in the dairy industry and the lawmakers on Capitol Hill may have finally gotten this right?
Well, thanks, Spencer. I think to your question, it's going to be much more evolutionary than revolutionary in this next farm bill. I think we made major improvements to the dairy safety net in 2018 by way of the farm bill and also the Bipartisan Budget Act. And as a result, as our witness Lolly Lesher testified yesterday, you have not only a dairy margin coverage program that's working much better than its predecessor, but you also have a wider array of risk management tools that dairy farmers can use on the crop insurance side. So while there's always room for tweaking in the next farm bill, I do think we're in a much, much better place than we've been in recent years.
Mm-hmm. As we look at some of those tweaks, though, as some of the participation on the part of the producers has lagged a little bit, frankly, do you think that the level of producer education is at a point where folks fully understand the safety net available to them?
Well, I think we've made a lot of progress there. I think one of the points we try to make, and Lolly hit this home in her testimony, is that DMC is really intended as a safety net to be there during difficult years. It may not necessarily pay out every year, even at that top coverage level, but as she said, she's signed up every year that the program has been in effect since 2019 because we want it to be there when producers are going to need it. Some years it's going to kick in, other years it's not going to. There can always be more producer education, but I think we have made great strides.
Mm-hmm. Aubrey, bringing you into the fold here, we hear so much about weather concerns facing the American producer, no matter where they are, but it seems like that weather concern in recent years in California has been drought, and more drought. Just looking at the current situation, for those of us that may not live in the state, may not drive through it on a daily basis, what are we looking at? Just how bad is it in California right now?
Well, it's been often described as the worst drought in a millennium, and I tend to agree. We have our entire water system, which in the West is predicated on the reclaimed system of dams and reservoirs that capture rain and snow, hold us through drought periods. They're actually designed to hold us through 3 years of drought. And those are at deadpool, meaning they are below the pumping mechanisms to actually move the water out. And they're at deadpool a year earlier than normal. A lot of that has to do with regulatory pressure and various legal challenges to the operating orders of the system. In addition to, we are in a really extreme drought cycle that seems to be lingering. So I kind of sit back and say, there really is no water. And in a drought scenario, it's about survival and what is the plan for when it rains. And so that really has become our focus at the Almond Alliance, working not only with our state partners who operate half of the system, but also our federal partners who operate the other half of the system. It really now is about recovery and resilience in the long term.
So now, Ethan, I want to switch to a bit of a different topic because we saw the Senate Agriculture Committee mark up the legislation from Senators Fisher and Grassley looking to mandate certain amounts of cash trade in the beef industry. Also saw them consider the special investigator bill. And anyone that's familiar with this program, you've been on it several times speaking about your and NCBA's opinion of both bills, knows where you stand. So I don't want to drill down on that, but I want to zoom out and look just more generally at your interpretation of the legislative calendar and legislative priorities. Do you think that Congress, considering that we haven't seen a ton of action specifically on that Fisher-Grassley bill in the House, do you think there's an appetite in Washington to address these two pieces of legislation yet this year?
You know, I think there's been a real evolution of the understanding of the impact of these bills and a lot better clarity on the need or maybe lack of need for these bills over the course of the last 2 years as we've kind of been through the process of now, I think, what, 7 hearings on this topic, an exhaustive amount of discussion, multiple versions of these bills. What we've seen is the market recover on its own. We have new pressures from input costs and drought and other things, but those underlying pressures that sort of led to this conversation initially have really sort of fallen by the wayside. We're seeing robust cash trade. We're seeing higher prices for producers. And those mandates that were really concerning and continue to be a source of concern for the vast majority of producers and the entirety of the economic community throughout the country, I think are much more well understood by lawmakers up on Capitol Hill. That doesn't mean they're not getting pressure from some of the lead sponsors of the bill to get this done and get it across the finish line. But I think what we're seeing is a much better understanding of the dangers of going down this path. And I think that is going to serve to deprioritize it, given some of the other concerns out there and other big ticket items before Congress right now.
We'll be right back to discuss the SEC climate reporting rule and its impact on agriculture with our panelists right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. The Securities and Exchange Commission is considering mandating climate reporting for publicly traded companies. The nation's farm groups are concerned about the reporting requirements that might pass down to the nation's farmers and ranchers. With a panel representing the almonds, dairy, and beef industries, we had to ask their thoughts on what they think the SEC rule might mean for farmers and ranchers.
Well, obviously, anytime we add an extra reporting requirement, it's a burden that trickles down, right? From reporting and gathering of data and making sure that we have that information available at not just scale for our larger entities, but also for our smaller entities who are out there. There's 7,600 almond farms. We have 80% of the world's almonds come out of California, which already is dealing with very strict state regulations as well. But a lot of our consumers are driving some of this reporting too. So I think for us, it's going to be about how we transition into the reporting and we have the resources and timeline available to accommodate bringing everyone together so that this doesn't negatively affect some of our smaller operations.
Mm-hmm. When you think of a farm product, an ag product with multiple uses, one has to think of fluid milk, which can of course be consumed as fluid milk, made into cheese, butter, yogurt, all kinds of fun stuff. Paul, your thoughts on what the diversity of dairy's uses and what that's going to mean for the reporting requirements that could potentially be on the way from the SEC?
Sure. So we submitted comments on this rule last week as well, and we highlighted the work that we're doing in the dairy industry to get to net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. And a big part of that effort is our Farm Environmental Stewardship Platform. That's a comprehensive approach to kind of measuring and monitoring the greenhouse gas footprint on dairy farms. And we've had very good uptake in that program so far, but we're continuing to make strides there. And a concern we have with mandating Scope 3 emissions, especially doing disclosures, doing them so soon, is that you're going to set back some of the trust that we've been working really hard to build in our voluntary efforts. And so it is a concern for us along the way. And I think we've urged that concern in our comments. And we've also noted that at minimum, a delay would be helpful to give us some more time to continue the work we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Ethan, when you think about the journey from farm to table, the beef cow, born on a cow-calf operation, sometimes transferred to a stocker, to a feeder, to a packer, a lot of steps in that production process. The proposed rule as written, how do you anticipate it would interpret all of those various steps involved in the beef cattle industry and some of the reporting requirements that might be needed as a result?
Well, I mean, quite frankly, you know, looking at our supply chain, looking at our exemplary environmental record, we have the lowest environmental footprint and lowest greenhouse gas emissions footprint in the world for cattle and beef production. We have a commitment in the industry to be climate neutral by 2040 and demonstrate that. We're on a really productive path, just like dairy is, as Paul just explained. So contemplating the SEC sort of usurping this role as an environmental overseer rather than their core mission is concerning to us for a variety of reasons, and that was noted in our public comments as well. But that's something that we're continuing to discuss as an industry and continue to try to educate folks here in Washington about the dangers of going down this path. We have mechanisms in place to provide that oversight, but you know, the primary overseer for publicly traded companies and large players in the stock market remaking themselves as the EPA is not necessarily an appropriate use of their authority.
Mm-hmm. Aubrey, as we look at this and look at what the kind of information the SEC is going to be looking for, what kind of information the consumer is looking for, as you mentioned, what does this tell you about the current level of discourse, the current relationship between producer and consumer, and perhaps, you know, areas where the producer could improve upon that relationship?
Sure. Not to get too philosophical, but we're six generations separated from the land. 1.5% of the population is feeding the other 98.5%. And while I think during the pandemic, there was this increased heightened sense of sensitivity to our food supply and where it comes from and how it gets to us, an unfortunate realization when you have shortages, and now we're seeing that stretch through on supply chain disruption as well. I do think that we have a disconnect with regards to the practices. And so it's something that we've worked on as an industry. The almond sector has actually done voluntary commitments on various climate actions across the spectrum, whether we're talking about carbon emission reduction, pollinator habitat development, water use and efficiency. These are all things that I think we could do a much better job of claiming our space and claiming our authority in that space. And bringing our consumer and our customers with us through that process. It's okay to say there's things we're striving for, as my fellow panelists have also described. But I think it's a great opportunity for us to do exactly what the other panelists have done, what we all have done, which is claim our space and say we are experts in what we do in the world.
So the SEC recently closing the comment period on that. The commission, of course, now considering those comments, and we await further discussion from the SEC on that, which we expect will come later this year, perhaps early next. Anyone that has the SEC's calendar, please forward it to my inbox. I'd certainly appreciate it. But I think that's going to do it for this week's panel. So Aubrey, Paul, Ethan, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, our Hannah Pegel takes a look at the baby formula news in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
If you or someone you know has a little one at home, they may have been impacted by the recent infant formula shortage. Abbott Laboratories is one of the biggest U.S. suppliers of powder infant formula, which includes Similac. In February, the company initiated a recall of its infant formula products and closed its Michigan plant after reports of serious bacterial infections in four infants. The recall and closure of the plant put a strain on U.S. supplies of infant formula, creating a national shortage. Abbott is about one out of four U.S. suppliers that produce 90% of the nation's formula supply. The reduction of the domestic infant formula supply in retail channels corresponds with surging imports of infant formula manufactured abroad, which is shown by this chart. Excluding certain non-dairy goods, imports of these products totaled 6.7 million pounds in April. That's a 1.6 million pound increase from March, and a 4.1 million pound year-over-year increase from April 2021. Mexico and Ireland were the leading suppliers of U.S. infant formula imports over that time. Although infant formula imports increased in March and April, the amount of it available in the U.S. significantly declined in May, partially as a result of surging consumer demand. To further mitigate the domestic infant formula shortage, the Biden administration began importing large volumes of formula from overseas under the name Operation Fly Formula. The first Operation Fly Formula landed in Indiana on May 22nd with more than 70,000 pounds of specialty formula, and the second flight landed in Virginia on May 25th with 100,000 pounds of formula. That's equivalent to about 1 million 8-ounce bottles. Abbott is in the process of reopening the Michigan facility, but the return to full production has been delayed by weather issues. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the week to come. Congress will be back home for a few weeks observing the Independence Day holiday, leaving much of the expected action to the Biden administration. On that front, the Department of Agriculture is set to release its annual acreage report on Thursday. Thursday will also bring USDA's quarterly reports on grain and rice stocks, as well as a monthly look at ag prices. As always, AgriPulse.com is your best bet to keep an eye on the latest happenings in farm policy in Washington and across the country. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.